My name is Mark Riley, and this is The Intersection, the intersection of politics and culture. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast, and we are careening headlong into primary season, that is for the Democrats, for the presidential nomination. We saw in Nevada, Bernie Sanders do an incredible job of wiping the floor with the other contestants, but more on that in a little bit. We also saw during the Nevada debate that Michael Bloomberg is not a great debater. And I don't know why anyone is surprised at this. Anybody who certainly has followed his career, as I have, during the time he was the mayor of New York City. Mike Bloomberg has always been stiff in debates. The public will tell you that Joe Biden did well in that debate. Elizabeth Warren did well in that debate, but not well enough to surmount what appears to be a really, really strong showing by Bernie Sanders. Now, about a week or so, maybe 2 weeks ago, I put up in, I guess it's social media, more on that later, that I thought when all is said and done, it's going to come down to Bernie Sanders versus Michael Bloomberg. And there were people who questioned why I said that, criticized me for saying that, and thinking that I was taking one side or the other in making that prediction. I wasn't. The fact of the matter is that when the dust settles, I just believe those will be the two last people standing. And I want to make one thing perfectly clear, at least from my own perspective. A political prediction has nothing to do with who I may think should win. My prediction is simply a political observation based on the lay of the land as I see it. And I have some reasons. And certainly the Nevada caucuses had nothing or did nothing to make me change this prediction. I see Bloomberg versus Bernie for several reasons. One, Bernie is building a commanding lead, and that now has been borne out in Nevada and in some recent polling. And if that polling is to be believed, there'll be a little more on that later. It's unlikely, that is, that his performance in the Nevada debate or the news that the Russians are trying to help his campaign, that's not going to dissuade Bernie Sanders' base from their strong support of their candidate. Neither will all the media caterwauling about how he either can't win or would be a disaster for the Democratic Party. And I have to say, some people in the media and in the punditocracy have conducted themselves shamelessly in terms of slamming Bernie Sanders, slamming the possibility that he could win the nomination. Oh, what will the moderates do? Blah, 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 blah. The fact of the and they all, or most of them anyway, say this because they believe Bernie cannot beat Donald Trump. I am not one of those people. I believe Bernie can beat Donald Trump. I think he might even beat Donald Trump handily. But we'll leave that for November, because that's if Bernie gets the nomination, that's when that test will in fact come. Now, social media plays a role, and I'm going to talk about social media later on in the podcast. They play a role in people's perceptions of political candidates. And all this back and forth and tweeting and trolling and Facebook posting about Bernie is not going to erode his base of support. He did surprisingly well in Nevada, by the way, among Latinos. And guess what? There may not be that many Latinos in South Carolina, but by Super Tuesday, when Texas and California start rolling in, that's going to make a difference, a base of Latino support. His black support, which was, I have to say, sadly lacking in 2016, appears to be, if not surging, increasing, and increasing to his benefit. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that Bernie's going to, in fact, get the nomination. There are still obstacles that he has to surmount, I think, in order to nail this thing down. One of those obstacles is Mike Bloomberg. Now, He is not contesting. He didn't contest Nevada. He's not contesting South Carolina. He's putting his whole foot in the water on Super Tuesday. That's the time that he is going to actually test his strength. A lot of people felt that his stiff debate meant that his support would be eroded. I think they're wrong. I think that Bloomberg, because he controls his own image through his own advertising, to which he spent, I believe, something on the order of $400 million to $500 million. That's $400 million to $500 million. He controls his own image. So the debate, while it may not have won him a number of fans, I don't think mortally wounded him. He's gonna rebound from this. His decision to reverse course on those non-disclosure agreements, at least three of them, that's a healthy start. Bloomberg is unique among the candidates in that he can continue to shape and reshape his public image. Don't expect a masterful performance from him at the next debate. It's not going to happen. This is not his strong suit. It's not in his DNA. But you see, debates do not always determine who a winner is in an election. They just don't. Donald Trump was not exactly the most skilled debater in the universe back in 2016, but he is president of the United States. So we need to keep that in mind as we look at this situation. Debates, polling, and fundraising are the three-legged table on which the media makes its money covering presidential campaigns. The fourth leg, of course, is the actual voting public, and the media hasn't yet figured out exactly how to monetize them before the November elections. That, in a nutshell, is why I think it's going to be Bloomberg against Bernie in the final round of the nomination sweepstakes. I could be wrong. Look, I'm human. I'm fallible. But I don't think I am in this instance. I think that the other candidates, I believe there are eight altogether, I think they're going to start falling off little by little. And by Super Tuesday, we may have three, maybe four people left. I think Joe Biden stays, even if he does not win South Carolina. And the stakes for him now are extremely high because, of course, South Carolina has a very large black voting population. And if they are not solidly in his corner, he could be out after South Carolina. But I don't think he will be. I think he'll do well enough in South Carolina to continue forth to Super Tuesday. Some of the others, I'm not sure they last that long. And part of that has to do with fundraising. Unlike Mike Bloomberg, the rest of these people have to go out and ask for money. Elizabeth Warren, Amy Klobuchar, all of you, Pete Buttigieg, they all have, and Tulsi Gabbard, who is not out of the race yet, and I'm leaving somebody out, I think it's Tom Steyer, is still in the race. The bottom line is, with the exception of Steyer, all the rest of them have to go out and try and raise money. And the fact of the matter is, it gets more and more difficult moving forward. If the poll numbers don't change, if the poll numbers don't put a particular candidate on an upward trajectory, then you find that they don't have the money to continue to compete. And that's happened to a number of people already. Kamala Harris was one. Cory Booker was one. When their numbers didn't get out of single digits, that was that. And we're going to see that continue to take place as this process moves forward. But I have to say, without saying I think Bernie or I support Bernie, put it that way, and keep in mind, I've interviewed both Bernie Sanders and Michael Bloomberg during my broadcast radio career, I have to say that they are treating Bernie, the media, the pundits, not all in the media. Let me be fair about this. It's not everybody in the media. But Bernie is operating at a handicap when it comes to media coverage. There's so much stuff. I mean, I read stuff every day about how, you know, he's going to get killed by being defined as a socialist. And what a lot of people don't understand is that our generation, my daughter's generation, don't look at socialism the same way their elders do. Now, they also, at this point, do not vote in the numbers that their elders do. But this could be the beginning of a trend. And it's going to be possibly the beginning of people saying, you know, socialism really is kind of a shibboleth. It's really just a label that somebody tries to use to impact someone negatively, impact a candidate negatively. And of course, that candidate is Bernie Sanders, who has been an unabashed socialist throughout most of his political career. And that really does count for some people, and it counts for young people. Young people looking for consistency, and Bernie gives them consistency. And if it comes down to Bernie versus Bloomberg, you're talking about a socialist versus an oligarch. And then you get these people that write these articles who say, well, Donald Trump must be happy as he can be to see Bernie versus Bloomberg. That would be something he would love. Well, who cares what he would love? Why would anybody who's seeking to unseat him care one bit about who he favors, who he supports, or who he thinks he has the best chance of beating? That's on him. That's not on the Democrats. But the Democrats do have some work to do. And I've said this before. The Democrats have to come together and pledge to support whoever gets the nomination. And I mean full-throated, wholehearted support. Now, people are going to argue, well, you know, Bernie supporters really didn't rally to Hillary Clinton. No, they didn't. And they didn't, many of them didn't, because they distrusted her because they felt she manipulated the process by which she got the nomination. Let's be real and down front about this. That was the feeling that many people had, many Bernie supporters had. And there's a risk, if Bernie is not the nominee, that they'll think that he got jobbed again. It's possible. But this time around, you have an incumbent who I think many Democrats, most Democrats, would argue, hey, he's got to go. And, I hear people talking about the possibility of Bernie supporters turning around and supporting Donald Trump. I don't buy it. I don't think it's going to happen. No way. Not in any way, shape, or form. It's possible that some might, but not enough to deliver a second term to Donald Trump. He needs a lot more than that. He needs to hold on to the people that elected him in 2016, even though it wasn't a majority. And he needs for the Democrats to infight so long and infight so hard that he has a natural advantage that he wouldn't have if everybody in the Democratic Party came together and decided to support whoever wins the process. I mean, that is why we have a process. I'm not the world's biggest fan of processes. But if we have a process here, and now, you know, you have Harry Reid saying get rid of caucuses, even though Harry Reid was the guy who engineered Nevada having an early caucus, God, how things change. But be that as it may, the bottom line here is that the party has to get its act together. The party has to say, okay, if it's Bloomberg, we're going to support Bloomberg. And that includes Bernie supporters. And if it's Bernie, the moderate wing of the party, who have yet to be tested on this, I might add, are going to have to jump up and say, you know what? We got Bernie's back because he is a better alternative to Donald Trump. A much better alternative than Donald Trump, than 4 more years of the lunacy that we've seen up to this point. Otherwise, you might as well just throw up your hands and give the man the election now. There's got to be some coming together. It's not going to be easy. It is not going to be easy, particularly if my prediction comes true. If it's Bloomberg versus Bernie, there's a lot of fences that are going to have to be mended. There's going to have to be a lot of back and forth. But that back and forth should not, cannot, must not prevent the party from coming together and defeating the man who is currently in the White House. Now, maybe you have a different view of how this will turn out. Or maybe you just have a different view from what I've just said. Join the conversation on my Facebook page at Mark Riley Media, MarkRileyMedia. Up next, well, I guess I got to talk about Trump a little bit. He slurs the indigenous. He slurs South Korea. He promotes yet another bootlicker and is angrier about the style of a congressional hearing than he is about the substance. This is The Intersection.
I ache in the places where I used to play, and I'm crazy for love, but I'm not coming on. I'm just paying my rent every day in the Tower of Song.
Welcome back to The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley, and thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Well, folks, it's another week in Trump land. I don't like to talk about this man. I don't like to give him any more publicity than he is ordinarily going to get otherwise. But this past week was just incredible. First of all, he again slurs the indigenous by referring to Elizabeth Warren as Pocahontas and referring to her as Indian and referencing her, quote, high cheekbones, unquote. Now, he's done this before. He's been criticized for it before. He knows he'll be criticized for it again. So you might want to ask yourself, why the deuce would he do it? Because his supporters love it. They love to hear him tweak people, even if it's racist. It's not something that troubles them, seemingly. Now, those supporters, which his minions now refer to as the 63 million, assuming they're talking about the 63 million that voted for him, they're now the dominant force in U.S. politics. Why do I say that? Well, all you have to do is ask them. They'll tell you that Donald Trump has this base of support, and that base of support is more than enough to win the upcoming election. Trump banks on the fact that his racist, misogynist excesses will never, ever cause these folks to abandon him. The frightening question is, what if he's right? 63 million Americans who believe Trump walks on water ought to scare the bejesus out of everyone else. If his racist slurs weren't enough, the man articulated a problem with the Korean film Parasite winning the Best Picture Oscar. He asked why no one's making films like Gone with the Wind anymore. It's like a South Korean film won the Oscar? What's up with that? When I heard this, Dave Chappelle came to mind for some reason. In one of his sketches, he says, and I'm quoting here, paraphrasing. He says, have you ever had something happen that was so racist you didn't even get mad? You were just like, God damn, that was racist. Well, so it was with Donald Trump, slandering Elizabeth Warren, and slandering Parasite. I didn't even get mad. Just when you think politics and politicians cannot get any lower, there is Donald Trump to remind us that yes, they in fact can. And as they say on TV, but wait, there's more. He's now appointed an acting director of national intelligence that, wait for it, has no intelligence experience. Apparently, Richard Grenell's main claim to fame is that he's a Trump toady. Oh wait, he's also the first openly gay member of this president's cabinet and ascends to the top of 17, count them, 17 separate intelligence agencies from his post as ambassador to Germany. To top that off, Trump named him acting national intelligence director. Acting, not permanent. That means he doesn't have to be confirmed by the Senate. All this highlights this president's fondness for bringing in yes men wherever possible. It also lays bare his distrust of tried and tested intelligence professionals. Now, that's not anything new. When the intelligence community said some things before that Donald Trump didn't like, he had no problem knocking them, slandering them, slurring them, however you want to describe it. No problem. Yet, when that same intelligence community comes up with conclusions that he agrees with, he has no problem quoting the same intelligence agencies that he has slandered and slurred in the past. Grinnell, Richard Grinnell, has wasted no time in ousting the agency's number two official and replacing him with a Trumpian conspiracy theorist. This is how Donald Trump rolls. And then there are his pardons, commutations, and clemencies. Let's see now. This is an interesting list. Michael Milken, Eddie DiBartolo, Rob Blagojevich, Scooter Libby, Dinesh D'Souza, Joe Arpaio, Bernie Kerik, and that's just to name a few. A regular rogues gallery. All these things are what the Trump presidency has wrought. And as it turns out, Donald Trump wouldn't have it any other way. I guess maybe I should have been skeptical when I realized that this man prefers to communicate with the American people through Twitter. But it is amazing to me that this is a man who blatantly and brazenly flouts, circumvents, goes around the law, slurs people, makes racist statements almost on a daily basis. And yet, people love him. There are people in this country who think that he is their savior. Evangelicals who are willing to overlook whatever his own personal foibles may have been before he got elected. And they, some of them, not all of them, but some of them, have given him some biblical stamp of approval that this is the man who is to lead America. Where, I don't know. But this is the man who will lead America to, I assume, the promised land or wherever it is that they think we're going. And that's why it makes no sense to me that his opposition is fragmented. Because the man does so many things on a regular basis. Fortunately, you don't hear all that much from him lately because he's over in India. I guess, you know, doing whatever it is he does with the heads of government, half of whom laugh behind his back. I'm not sure the Indian leadership is one of those. Of course, we could get into a long and very ugly discussion about his going to India at the same time he calls indigenous people Indians, but that's a whole other discussion for another day. It is, to me, mind-boggling. It is a mind-boggling situation that this country finds itself in, where we have a president who is so cavalier, who is so, I guess, for want of a better term, shameless, that he puts people in sensitive positions without a shred of experience in operating within the positions that he's appointed them to. How do you do that? How do you form your lips to say, I nominate Richard Grinnell as acting director of national intelligence? It makes no sense, except that he wants somebody at the top who will fill the lower echelons of the intelligence community with Trump yes men, so that when they say that Bernie Sanders may be the beneficiary of Russian hacking or Russian attempts to try and help his campaign, then Trump can say, well, you know, they're absolutely right. But if that same intelligence community turns around and says, you know what, I think, or we think, the intelligence community has information to believe that the Russians are helping Donald Trump again, he throws up his hands and says, these people are all full of crap. They don't know what they're doing. I know more about intelligence than the intelligence community. Now, he said something, I'm kind of paraphrasing what he said, but that's kind of sort of where he goes with this stuff. It is amazing. It is troubling. And I think to many people, it is and ought to be frightening. Let me know what you think. Leave a comment on my Facebook page or message me in my inbox at Mark Riley Media. When we come back, I'm going to tackle a little bit about social media. This is The Intersection.
Join the conversation at Mark Riley Media on Facebook.
Welcome back to The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley. Thank you so much for listening. I really, really do appreciate it. Now, I've been warned not to go off the deep end about social media. I've been told that since I use it, I ought to be circumspect and not critical. But I can't help myself. I don't understand why grown human beings allow Facebook, Twitter, and the like to seemingly rule their lives. I mean, to an extent, I can understand young people allowing this stuff to influence them. I mean, the first time somebody told me that there was a category of human being called influencers, I thought they were joking. I thought it was something from The Onion or something. But I understand why young people are influenced to a greater degree than somebody my age. I mean, after all, many kids today have never lived in a world without social media. They take the hurtful, ugly things that are said to and about them very, very much to heart. And for young people, I totally understand. I really do understand. But less understandable is how some grown people, people who ought to know better, respond the same way. Why is it so difficult to unplug from the various social media tools when you're attacked, that is, by trolls? I mean, maybe I'm very lucky. I use social media to stay in touch with family and friends, and not for a heck of a lot else, although the executive producer of this program might disagree. I've been trolled a couple of times, and when it's happened, I have just refused to engage. Why should I? I have no reason to. Eventually, in my case, the trollers go away. Are people less than whole if they delete one or more of their social media accounts? Is this really the nuclear option that people make it out to be? I mean, I've talked before about other elements of social media. I personally find, repugnant. For example, trying to influence U.S. elections, regardless of who's doing it, regardless of who is the beneficiary, that's a function of people paying way too much attention to the tentacles of social media. It's becoming difficult in some cases to figure out what's a lie, what's the truth, and what is just someone's opinion, and not always someone's informed opinion. It used to be easy, at least for me, because I was trained to kind of discern fact from fiction. So it wasn't a real problem for me before the advent of social media. But, and I should say in fairness, that not all of this foolishness is a function of social media. You know, people were trying to manipulate the truth going back to the beginning of politics in this country anyway. But it's amazing to me that social media seems to be the conduit for eventually creating a world where there is no truth, where there are no facts, only what those with the most followers say is the truth. If they decide to manipulate facts or turn malevolence against an innocent person, it then becomes fact to those who see it. Long story short, I'm starting to think social media is eroding critical thinking in too many people, both young and old. And I mean, critical thinking was something that I learned at a very young age. And it wasn't like somebody sat me down and said, oh, today I'm going to teach you critical thinking. I had family members. I had some very brilliant instructors in high school, in college, in drum and bugle corps. who helped me think critically about the world around me and encouraged me to question. And when I hear that people commit suicide or, you know, change the trajectory of their lives based on what somebody else says about them on Twitter or on Facebook, I don't get it. I don't understand it. Now, I'm sure there are rational, reasonable explanations for this. And as I mentioned before, children and young people, never having really lived in a situation where there was no social media, probably place a great deal more emphasis on social media's impact in their lives than I do. Social media is something that I can take or leave. I did go through one situation where somebody accused me of committing a crime in the Philippines, and I had never been to the Philippines. But that got squashed like very, very, very quickly. And the person who made the accusation had to go, I forgot even what social media tool they were using, but they had to say, no, that's not true. So for me, that was the end of it. I don't ruminate on these things. And maybe it's just because I'm lucky, because my family and my friends are the only reason I really need to use social media for. Anything else? All of the Sturm and Drang and tweets from this one and that one, and that includes, by the way, the President of the United States. To me, it's all sad. And the saddest part of all may be that it's inexorable and that it never will change. My thanks to our executive producer of The Intersection, Ms. Kim Jack Riley, who never challenges my opinions or what I say in this podcast. Until we meet again, please stay well.